Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Our topic today are the 9 Principles of Economics, 101, with Dr. Art Cardin. Welcome, Art.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Yeah, I'm really glad you could be with us today. So, everyone, I want you to know that Dr. Art Cardin is the Assistant Professor of Economics and Business at Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee, and an adjunct fellow with the Oakland, California-based Independent Institute. His many works can be read at Mises.org, that's M-I-S-E-S.org, as well as Forbes.com and ArtCardin.com. So I'm very, very pleased that you could be with us today, Art, and I am also very happy to also introduce our special commentator, Mr. Aaron Brown. Welcome, Aaron.
Glad to be here.
So, folks, Aaron is a student of economics at the University of San Diego, California, and a recent graduate of Mises University 2010. So, Art, before going into your 9 principles, I want to mention that I am sure that you and Aaron as well have run into many people who say, I really don't understand economics, which I find rather incredible since we are all naturally economic beings. It's only that we haven't learned to understand these ABCs intellectually. I'm reminded of a quote by Ludwig von Mises here that economics is the pith of civilization and of man's human existence. So I'd like to know what you, Art, say when people make the comment, I really don't understand economics.
That's fine and well, as long as it's not backed by, or as long as it's not immediately followed with a statement of a very strong opinion about something where a sound understanding of economics is a prerequisite.
Mm-hmm.
My friend, or a friend of mine once said that after a speech, he stood up during the questions and answers and said, it's always perplexed me how someone will say, I'm not an economist, and then proceed to spend the next hour proving it.
Mm. Yes. Yeah, that's very important. So, you know, it is something I've also noticed that in getting into conversations with people, they will admit that they do not understand economics, and then they have very strong opinions about what economics is and should be. And
right.
It is interesting that people do feel that this is in the realm of opinion as opposed to an actual science.
Right. This gets back to a conversation I have with my students, or a running conversation I have with my students at Rhodes, because we're changing our curriculum a little bit, and we have now it's just a 1-semester introduction to economics class, and I keep telling them over and over again that what economics does is it defines the non-negotiable constraints on social reality.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have the option of not believing that demand curves slope downward and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
So
we're not going to go into those kind of technicalities for our listeners today.
Right.
I'd like to just say that what we're really talking about here at Radio Free Market is reality economics, because reality is not optional.
Right.
And that's basically what we want everybody to understand. And today we're really going to focus on the ABCs of these 9 principles of economics. Now, we are actually going to run out of time in this segment here, and I'm afraid that I'm not going to let you get too far into your question, Aaron, because I know I wanted you to start off with the question related to this first principle that that Art lays out here. And so I'm going to actually just kind of sort of introduce it, and then I'll let you pick it up when we come back from the break. And
right.
That is that you mentioned it, that the very first principle is that people act. And this is very interesting because this is the foundational statement of Ludwig von Mises' book, Human Action. And it is a non-debatable point, because we all do that. And to debate this point would actually be to contradict it. So, unfortunately, again, I'm not going to be able to let you respond to this because we're going to have to take a break right now. So please stay with us, folks. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay. And I'm going to throw the ball to you, Aaron. And so please go ahead and let's discuss your first question on this first principle of the nine principles of economics.
Thank you. Well, you know, a lot of the principles there, they seem very intuitive, but it's hard to articulate. And I think the idea that people act, we can all see it, but it's very overlooked in economics today. So I wanted to ask you, what is your take as to why should the concept that people act, why should that be the starting point for trying to answer questions about economics?
When Mises was writing, he was writing in a very different day, when you know this idea that people acted, that they were volitional about what they did, was contested by a lot of people. And this is I think one of the fundamental principles that we really have to recognize is that people make decisions based on the fact that they have goals. They may not necessarily be able to articulate those goals all the time, but pretty much everything that people do is in the pursuit of some end, or it's in the pursuit of some type of goal that they want to achieve, no matter how mundane it happens to be. We don't just get tossed about. You know, we're not ships at sea, sort of at the mercy of the vicissitudes of the market or of society, but rather we take all of the information, all the stuff that's swirling around us, and we use that to inform conscious action.
Mm-hmm. And so specifically to economics, you know, I know that Mises, you know, the definition of economics is just the study of people acting. So in terms of economics, why should that be the foundational, when we're starting to look at economic analysis, we don't look at data, we look at people and how people are going to respond to certain policies?
In large part, theory is going to precede analysis. So we have to have at least some framework by which we interpret the world. Because again, as I tell my students from time to time, beware of facts that appear to speak for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you don't have a coherent body of theory, then those facts are meaningless. It's not even clear that they're even information. So once you begin with the idea that people are moving towards some kind of goal that they would like to achieve, whatever that goal happens to be, whether it's you know driving to my office or having a phone conversation or something to that effect, all of the data, all of the information that gets produced by the market or that gets produced by all voluntary actions starts to make sense.
Now, this is Michael speaking, and I've seen that Ludwig von Mises, one of obviously the most influential Austrian economists, refer to this principle that people act as the action axiom.
Right.
Could you enlighten us as to what an axiom is, first off, and why Mises thought the action axiom was so important to the discussion of economics?
An axiom, as I understand it, is a statement that is just self-evidently true. So action is axiomatic in that to deny that people act is to act, in fact. So if you deny that people act, you have to act in order to deny that. So you can't deny that people act without assuming that people act.
So this is the foundational principle upon which Austrian economics is really developed.
Right. Yeah, and I would argue all social science should be or can be deduced from or informed by this fact that people act.
It's a very important principle. So, Aaron, go ahead.
Okay, and so the second principle that you laid forth in your article is that people act. So that's the first principle. And the second principle is that every action has a cost. And, again, it's something that it's intuitive, and it's almost so intuitive that it's hard to analyze unless you've had a background in economics. So, you know, no one really ponders the fact that when he or she watches a TV for an hour, that the cost of that action is, you know, not being able to exercise or not being able to study. So can you clarify why is it that when you do one thing, you forego doing another thing?
Well, time is scarce, you know, first and foremost. So since you have limited time, you have to choose. You have to choose what you do with that time. So you can, you know, like I said. So the article to which you're referring is something I put on the Mises blog that's based on a handout that I gave to my Econ 100 students. And you know, where a lot of people don't fully grasp or don't fully understand that there really is no such thing as a free lunch. That to do one thing is of necessity to not do another. And often, so for example, when you watch political debates about policy, they'll talk about, say, like the ethanol program, as if, you know, this will create however many jobs, or this will create, or this will wean us off of foreign oil, or this will do this, or this will do the other thing. And very, very few people are asking, okay, what are we giving up in order to be weaned off of foreign oil? What are we giving up in order to create these jobs in agriculture? I spent a lot of time writing about the minimum wage, for example, and people don't seem to understand that that a higher minimum wage comes at a cost in the form of fewer opportunities, primarily for young, unskilled workers.
You know, this is an extremely important point. I want to jump in here. In some of our recent interviews that we've aired on Radio Free Market with Jeff Tucker and others, we got into the concept of a second step of logic. And what you're bringing out right now, Art, is so critically important because my 16-year-old daughter, who I've been homeschooling for many years, we were having this conversation just this past weekend about a second step of logic. And I said, this is the fundamental reason why there's a lot of difficulty in people understanding economics, because they don't go to that second step of logic. And she said, well, give me an example. And I used exactly what you were just talking about right now, this that there is no such thing as a free lunch. I said, people have to understand in the context of that particular statement that somebody always pays. In other words, you have to extend that statement one more time, or in the concept of choice, that you have to therefore give up something. There's a second step of logic. And this is a habit that I see that would serve everyone if we could just inculcate that particular habit of people taking a second step of logic, or asking other people to take things a second step of logic, like you're doing your students.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Thomas Sowell refers to economics as the art of thinking past stage one, or asking and then what about any proposition. Mm-hmm. Economics asks and then what, and then what, and then what, and then what, and then finally. Often in the case of government policies, we find out that we get exactly the opposite of what we think that we're trying to do.
So please go ahead, Art.
Okay, the third principle, and this my roommate is from Chicago, and he's kind of the person that introduced me to libertarianism. And one of the things that got my mind going was that he kept saying incentives, and that was your third principle, is that people respond to incentives. And the principle just states that incentives motivate people to act, like when your mom says, you know, I'll give you $5 to clean up your room. Now, you define price in your article as a motivating factor. How do prices come about?
Prices come about through the competing bids and offers of buyers and sellers in a market economy. So when we talk about a market, we're not talking about some supernatural force, or we're not talking about some non-human entity with mind, emotion, and will. We're
right.
just talking about a collection of buyers and sellers who, at any point in time, are making a bid or are making an offer. They're either bidding for a good or they're offering a good at some price. And the bargaining process is what ultimately produces the market price.
Yeah, in a practical sense, you know, everybody has day-to-day examples of these incentives in motion. Aaron, when you and I were talking about this earlier, you mentioned remembering when your mother said that she'd give you a few bucks if you clean your room. Now, there's an incentive.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And among the things that I think people take from studying economics carefully is a much more nuanced view of where prices come from. It is absolutely not true that employers can pay whatever they can pay or whatever they choose to pay, and it's absolutely not true that sellers can charge whatever they want to sell, or excuse me, whatever they wish to charge. And the reason for that is because under competition, if you insist on paying someone less than what they can produce, someone else is going to step into the gap and hire that person away from you. In the same way, if you insist on charging, I don't know, let's say $500 for a gallon of gas, then you can be reasonably certain that someone else is going to step into the gap and offer an almost perfect substitute for that gallon of gas for a much lower price.
Well, I may be covering the similar ground like that you've just mentioned, but I'd like to go over this again from a slightly different angle. You know, we've talked about how prices come about, and in your article you mentioned, you pointed out that prices are powerful incentives when it comes to making people take action. But you wrote something that I think is very important for people to know about prices and how they relate to supply and demand. And you said that what you said was that people will do less of a certain thing as a cost rises, and also
right.
that people will try to supply more of a certain thing as it becomes more profitable. Or to put it another way, price is determined by the consumer or is imputed backwards. Could you please
right.
clarify briefly this very important idea?
Yeah, so price ultimately comes from the value that something has in terms of the satisfactions it can deliver for somebody. So if I'm willing to pay $2 for a cup of coffee, that means that I'm willing to forego anything else I could get with $2 to get a cup of coffee. And that action, that transaction, the fact that I might be willing to give up $2 to get a cup of coffee is what's ultimately going to give value to everything that goes into the production of the coffee. It's going to produce the value. That's where the value of the labor of the barista at Starbucks and the value of the coffee beans and the value of everything through the supply chain comes from. It comes from the fact that people are at sort of the end of a production process.
Okay, I'm
going to
have to interrupt you now, Art. I'm sorry, I'm
oh,
going to
sure.
have to interrupt you. And we're going to have to come back right after the break, folks, and continue this conversation on the miracle of prices and choices. Please stay with us. And welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay. And with me today is Dr. Art Cardin, and we're talking about the 9 principles of Economics 101. And we were just talking about prices and how prices are actually created. And I wanted to also ask you to explain a little bit more about this, Art. If you could please explain how the consumer determines what will be produced. You know, there's a quote that pearls aren't valuable because men die for them. Men die for them because they are valuable.
Right.
So please, if you would comment on that.
Yeah, what gives something value is the fact that someone is willing to sacrifice his or her property to get it. If I'm willing to spend my time or my energy or my money in the pursuit of something, that's what gives it value. The fact that it can satisfy me in some way is what's going to make it valuable. So, for example, to pursue the pearls analogy, I've been married now for a little bit over 7 years, and we have 2 beautiful children. And one of the things that I value,
by the way,
sorry, oh, thank you, I appreciate that. One of the things that I value very highly is my wife's happiness. So I'm willing to sacrifice in order to get that. And I don't want to make a promise I can't keep necessarily. But if I value, Given the way that I value her happiness, if I think that a pearl necklace is an input into that hat, into her happiness and therefore my happiness, then I'm going to value that pearl necklace. I'm going to be willing to trade something for it, the fruits of my labor, expressed in my money income, and then that's going to give the pearls value. That's going to give the pearl divers labor value. That's going to give the people who make pearl necklaces value, or excuse me, that's going to give their labor value, and so on and so forth down the line. So the people are going to dive for the pearls because they can be used to make pearl necklaces that will make my wife happy and that will therefore make me happy. One of the truly beautiful things about this is that I don't have to know where pearls come from, even. I don't have to know how to make a pearl necklace. I don't need to know how to culture pearls or anything like that. All I need to know is where to find a good jewelry store.
Mm-hmm. So we're talking about the third principle we're still on it, is that incentives motivate people to action.
Right.
And in your article, you talked about an entrepreneur will go into a certain industry because profits are high. And I like to bring it back to real life because I like personally seeing concrete examples. So can you give us a real-life example of this that you've seen where an entrepreneur or a certain industry expands because the profits are so high?
An entrepreneur expands into an industry because profits are high. The PC market in the late 1970s through the 1980s, 1990s, et cetera, attempts to compete with Microsoft and Apple. People were pursuing very, very high or very, very, very large profit opportunities. Any gas station, there's going to be enormous competition in a local market for gasoline where people are going to be entering and exiting because they want to find ways to produce more profitably or to build the proverbial better mousetrap. Restaurants are a clear example of a situation in which people are perpetually seeking profits and innovating accordingly. Once firms like McDonald's saw nationwide success and started earning money hand over fist, they spawned an ocean of competitors.
Mm-hmm. It's funny. I'm looking at my cue cards right now. My example was PCs. The perfect example because, look at what we can get for, $500. You can get a computer that, used to be the size of, a tank or, an entire house. So I think that's a really good example. It's just the miracle of when people demand something, the price will come down because people have incentive.
Yeah. Well, yeah, over time, and this is one thing that introductory economics honestly doesn't handle as well as it should, and that's the incentives for innovation in the future. As people have opportunities to interact with one another, to trade and to cooperate, they also have an incentive to divide their labor and innovate. So, for example, you mentioned high-quality computers. My wife and I got iPhones a couple of weeks ago, and these things have absolutely changed our lives. We can carry around in our pockets probably more computing power than existed in the world, almost certainly 100 years ago, almost definitely, and possibly probably 50 years ago.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. It's amazing the array of options that you have with these with the iPhone and the iPad. It's astounding. Yeah,
yep.
I recently made that switch myself.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. It's,
so I'm going to jump in here because we're going to actually bridge into, just for a brief moment, to talk about something fairly technical, which is your fourth principle, that people make decisions at the margin, that economic analysis, incremental. Now, I don't want to get too technical, and we are going to run out of time, and so I'm going to give you less than a minute to respond to this, so please go ahead.
Okay. This is one of the hardest concepts in all of economics. People are always, always, always making trade-offs. When we're engaged in economic analysis, we're comparing the cost and benefits of a little bit more of something to the cost and benefits of a little bit less of something. So, for example, coffee. We don't make categorical decisions like coffee is always good or coffee is always bad, but at the margin, am I willing to sacrifice a little bit more? Am I willing to sacrifice another $2 to get a cup of coffee?
Okay. So I am going to have to interrupt you, and we are going to have to take another break. When we come back, we'll wrap this particular question up, and then we'll move on because we have some wonderful other questions that we want to ask you and get into. So everyone, please stay with us. This is Radio Free Market. We'll be back in just a minute. And welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market. And I'm going to hand this back over to Aaron. So please, Aaron, go ahead.
All right. So during the Mises exams, I got a question about the paradox of value. And this was actually really hard for me, so I'm really excited to hear your answer. And the paradox of value was that early economists, they couldn't explain, water is obviously more valuable than diamonds. But diamonds are much more expensive. Why is that?
The reason for that is because it rests in a sense on a false premise. When we talk about value, value is always determined at the margin. We're comparing what we can get from the marginal unit of something to what we can get from the marginal unit of something else.
And the marginal unit you mean is the last unit.
Right. Yeah. One more or one less.
Right.
So I'll run through. I cover this example in class, and one thing that I've done is I've asked, how successful would I be if I were to offer, if I were to try to start selling Cardin's Halative H2O or something like that, like my own patent medicine that's just water, and offered it for $100,000 a bottle with the slogan, "You'll die without it." And most students are pretty clear on why they're not willing to pay $100,000 for a bottle of water, and so on and so forth. And that's because water is so abundant that, say, one more half-pint bottle of water, at least in the United States, the marginal use of that or the additional value we get from that is maybe putting it in a balloon and throwing it at a friend. That's not something people value very highly. Whereas one more diamond, people can use that to get engaged. And presumably people place a very, very, very high value on the happiness of their future spouse.
But the supply of that water is directly related to its value. So if you're in the desert and you're holding the last bottle of water, and attending a millionaire's conference, and you put it up for auction, $100,000 might be a short price.
Oh, certainly. Know? Yeah. Yeah, because when you have very, very few bottles of water, when water is extremely scarce, then the additional satisfaction you get from a bottle of water might be the additional satisfaction you get from not dying. And people are going to be willing to sacrifice an awful lot for that. Today, though, at least in Memphis, water is very, very abundant. And the additional value that we get from that is filling up a kiddie pool or what have you. Water is so super abundant that an additional pint of water we really won't miss.
And by the way, folks, we're going to be having a show in the near future, so please watch for it. We're going to have a show probably in the next few weeks on water and property rights. We're working to set that up right now. I have a question I want to insert. Does economics actually try to tell people what they should be doing?
Oh, never. No. No, economics as such cannot say anything about people's values. Basically, what we do is to say, given whatever values people have, we have a body of principles that will help us analyze the consequence, or analyze and sometimes predict a little bit the consequences of their actions. It's, I think, an unfortunate misconception that people think that economics and economists prescribe selfishness.
Okay. So we're going to move on to principle 5, which is, again, one of these things. You do it every day, but that trade makes people better off. And it's, people kind of laugh at you if you made such an obvious statement. But Murray Rothbard said that the very existence of a trade, the fact that a trade took place, means that both people must end up better off. And why is that?
Well, basically, you wouldn't do something, you wouldn't enter into a trade unless you expect it to be better off. This gets back to the action axiom. You're not going to do things that you expect to hurt you, or you're not going to do things that you expect to make the world a worse place. However you choose to define that. So even for a masochist, we'll say, or for someone who wishes to see everyone in the world killed, or something to that effect, everything they do is going to be in the pursuit of some goal that they think makes the world a better place, however they choose to define that. So in the case of trade, it's a common misconception to say that one person won and one person lost, or to talk about one person getting the better end of a trade. You see this in sports all the time. People are asking, which team won and which team lost, and when the Cardinals traded their third baseman to the Padres for their first baseman or something like that. And the fact of the matter is people are only willing to enter into that exchange because they expect to be made better off as a result.
Well, in your article, you simplify the concept of the division of labor by relating it to trade. And this term, division of labor, is something that I've been really focused on these last many shows. I've been focused on this quote by Ludwig von Mises that social cooperation equals the division of labor. And please tell us how trading makes everyone better off, even if they are not directly involved in the trade.
How does trade make everybody better off, even if they're not directly involved in the trade? That's kind of interesting because it does a couple of things. First, specialization allows us to produce more stuff with fewer resources. So trade allows us to produce more stuff with fewer resources. It allows us to produce the same stuff at lower cost. It literally expands all of our possibilities. So in the case of, so say that you have Farmer Jones in Nebraska who's trading wheat or corn to Farmer Smith in Kansas, who's giving up wheat, then they're able to actually reduce the amount of land that it takes to generate all of the corn and all of the wheat that people need in both states. And that additional land can be used to satisfy all sorts of other wants. It can be used to build housing. It can be used to build, one of my students suggested a corn maze. You know, anything could happen. So literally what trade does is it expands our range of possibilities.
Yeah, and there's always the subsidiary services that are required in order to create any particular trading event that we're completely oblivious to. We don't even know how many different millions of individuals have been involved in the preparation or transportation of the materials that suddenly became the objects of our interaction. You know, the sandwich.
Yeah, this actually gets to an important point raised by Adam Smith and more recently elaborated on by Vernon Smith, who won the Nobel Prize in Economics a few years ago. Smith points out that if we want people to cooperate with us, if we want people to do things for us, we're better off if we appeal to their self-love. And what I think is the most magical and interesting implications of economics is that you don't have to care about someone in order to care for them. Vernon Smith points out markets economize on the need for virtue. They don't eliminate it, but just merely the fact of drinking a cup of coffee means that you're helping to set the table for someone on the other side of the world who grew that coffee that you may not know.
Well,
so Aaron,
that's a really interesting
back
point.
To you.
All right, so I'm going to hold on. I'm going to get my I Love Mark shirt on real quick, and I'm going to ask you a question from the uninformed, the anti-free market opposition. Capitalism is just the manager exploiting the working classes for cheap labor. This is not just. So how can you say that trade makes us better off when, you know, a person working for subsistence labor is working for, you know, the evil capitalist and he's just being exploited? How would you respond to that?
Well, the most obvious thing is to point out that it's not true. Even if you wanted to take a purely data-driven approach, you know, the evidence suggests higher value of industrialization accrued to the working class or accrued to low-wage, low-skill workers in the form of higher wages for unskilled labor. I think I too share concern, obviously, for people around the world who are much worse off, obviously, than we are. But the answer to that is to remove barriers to competition.
Mm-hmm.
Because if someone is truly being exploited, if someone's being exploited by evil capitalists, then the question we have to ask is, well, what's preventing other evil capitalists, other greedy capitalists, from coming in and hiring those workers away at a slightly higher wage? So that entire body of thinking is incoherent because it posits that there's some exploiter who's very, 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 very greedy and who's able to extract these profits from the working class, but that there's no one else who's so greedy that they would go in and hire those workers at a slightly higher wage in order to enjoy higher profits themselves.
I just wanted to interject on the individual level. You know, I asked the question, you know, could it be that the person, the individual earning the low wage, that they actually prefer that low wage to any other activity that they could be doing with the time that they spend earning that wage.
Right. Yeah, and that's an important point, especially when we talk about things like sweatshops or when we talk about things like anything related to international trade and related to the poor. My friend David Henderson has said before that you don't do people any service or you don't do them any favors by taking away from them the choice that they actually make. Mm-hmm. So in the case of unskilled workers, doing everything that we can, I think, to expand their range of options, either through open immigration, I think, or open free or complete free trade. These, I think, are the solutions to global poverty. Telling people, no, you're not allowed to make this decision because I think it's icky, is, while not technically economics, I think is not the sort of values that we want to inculcate in our students and children and friends.
Well, I'm going to move on to the sixth principle of economics that you mentioned, which are that people are rational, and people will tend to do things that will make them better off. And Aaron, I'm going to hand this over to you so you can extend that into
your
question.
All right. So, you know, the point I wanted to bring up is, you know, what does the fact that people are rational, what does this mean in terms of action? Do you have to agree with what someone does, or is it simply their choice? Do people just make mistakes, and they may not be rational, but they're acting in their own self-interest, and they might err. Could you just expand on the fact that people tend to do things that will make them better off, but they're not omniscient. They don't know everything.
Right. Yeah, there are a lot of different ways to think about this. I think the way that I think of rationality in economics, I think of it as just purely a definition. You know, people make decisions in the face of costs and benefits, and they try to do things that they think will make them better off. It's not always clear that their cognitive functioning is perfectly consistent with that. But over time, presumably the market will reveal these errors, or reveal errors that people commit, and also reveal ways for them to try to correct those errors.
So they don't have to be correct in their
their
decision. They can actually be wrong. They can believe that the world is flat, but that feels like a very rational decision.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. When I say that people are rational. And one of the reasons why I say I think this is a lot more controversial than it needs to be is I'm just saying that people make choices, whatever those choices happen to be, consistent with what they believe to be their goals, or consistent with their goals, whatever those goals happen to be, and consistent with whatever mental models people have of the world that says this is an appropriate action, or this is an appropriate action that will help me to achieve these ends. It by no means means that people won't make mistakes.
So I wanted to ask, so did someone, let's say, who invested all their life savings on 32 black in a game of roulette, did they do something irrational, or did they just do something maybe subjectively stupid?
Ill-advised.
Ill-advised.
Yeah.
And that person maybe wasn't – it was stupid, but it doesn't mean it was irrational. That person obviously had an objective. They had thought – that roulette was a means to their ends of the satisfaction that they would have attained by having that money.
Yeah. I would say there's a difference between people doing something foolish and people doing something and doing something that is irrational. And I think this is where we tread a very fine line, because when I talk to my colleagues in the psychology department, when I talk about people being rational in economics, I think I mean something very different from what they mean by people being rational in psychology. I just mean that people act in accordance with whatever their chosen ends happen to be. And I think my colleagues in psychology tend to, and I could be overspeaking here, but I think they tend to think of a rational person being someone who has a correct model of how the world works.
I think that's a very important point. We should maybe talk about that a little bit more at another time, and maybe bring a psychologist in on that conversation, on that element. That's very interesting. I want to move on to the seventh principle here of using markets is costly, but using government can be costlier still. And so I think we've come up with a way to frame this argument that is beneficial for all parties involved, and that is, when someone enters into a government job, do they cease to be human? That is, say, when someone gets a government job, do they cease to be looking out for their own self-interest? So you can actually answer this yes or no.
Yeah, I think it's manifestly obvious that people are still looking out for their self-interests when they enter a government job. It's, I think, unfortunately naive of social scientists to put the burden of proof on the market and say, okay, well, why should we allow people to engage in these voluntary transactions? Well, they show me that they shouldn't be allowed, or that show me that we should allow you to force other people to act in accordance with your values, or something to that effect.
And if the debate could be framed that way, I think that would be very helpful, because that's true. It is always, it seems to be that the market is always on the defensive.
Right. Yeah, I was saying to a friend, especially when you look at the things that governments have done, the governments did in the 20th century, it honestly, it's a bit of a puzzle to me as to why libertarians don't have the moral high ground.
So a couple of things that people in government propose to, you know, to help out the economy, whether, you know, their mind is in the right place or not, but they want there to help us out to correct so-called market failures are things like price controls, subsidies,
right,
taxes, and you were saying minimum wage laws. So you're saying these things, price controls, subsidies, minimum wage, you're saying these things make the situation worse.
Oh, yeah. I'm only going to give you 10 seconds to answer this question, Eric.
Yes. That's basically it. And any interference with the price mechanism will almost certainly make things worse.
Yes. All right, so we're going to be coming back in just a few minutes, folks, for our final segment. So please stay with us. This is Radio Free Market. We're talking with Dr. R. Cardin and Aaron Brown on the 9 Principles of Economics 101. So stay with us. We'll be right back. And welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm going to hand the next question over to you, Mr. Aaron Brown.
All right. So right before the break, we had briefly talked about how minimum wage laws, among other things, make the situation worse as a government interference. Can you give us an example of why this is so? I've actually been reading some of your stuff on the minimum wage law. So why would a minimum wage law, which is supposed to raise everyone's living standards, why does this actually do the opposite?
Basically what it does is it takes people who are not very productive and it prices them out of the labor market. So we mentioned the way that we frame economic policy questions a little bit ago, and people like a policy that says, okay, you're not allowed to pay people less than $7.25 an hour. If we rephrased that and said, okay, impoverished person, you're not allowed to work for less than $7.25 an hour, I think people might react to it somewhat differently. Firms that are out there seeking profits, and that's presumably everybody, or presumably all firms, or anyone, what they're going to do is they're going to try to hire as many hours of labor as are worth whatever the prevailing wage happens to be. So if you can only produce $7 an hour worth of stuff, and the minimum wage is $7.25 an hour, you find yourself out of work, or you find yourself completely out of luck.
Mm-hmm. And one of the best book that I've read is Economics in One Lesson by Hazlitt, and he said, just like you said, it creates a permanent sector of unemployment as opposed to raising people's living standards.
Right.
So, okay, so we're going to
go on to the eighth principle, Aaron, if you would.
All right. So the eighth principle, you talked about how profits, it's actually a signal. It tells businesses that they are taking resources and they're doing something good with it because people want it. People give up their hard-earned money and their labor for it. So how does, the example of, let's say, two shoemakers, you know, one shoemaker offers, he's efficient and he offers shoes at a price that people want, and the other shoemaker doesn't. He's inefficient, and so he prices the shoes too high, so people don't like it. So how does the example of the shoemaker show that the person who is going bankrupt, how are they wasting resources?
Basically, what happens when a firm earns a profit, they take factors of production, labor, capital, raw materials, and land, and all this other stuff, that people have expectations about what all of this stuff can produce. And the producer who earns a profit takes all of this stuff and shows that everybody's expectations were wrong. In fact, actually, all of this can be used to produce something that is more valuable. So in the case of the shoemaker, the really, really good shoemaker, who, let's suppose, produces absolutely amazing shoes, he shows that everything that can go into shoemaking can, in fact, be used to make better shoes than everybody thought before, and he's going to be rewarded for his foresight. if someone...
Well, you know,
I'm going to have to interrupt you here,
Art. Sure. I'm going to have to ask you to make a comment on the ninth principle, or we're not going to have time to even discuss it at all. Unfortunately, we're coming to the end here. And we have Henry Hazlitt's great summation of economics. We shouldn't ignore the long-term and unintended consequences of policies and actions. In as few seconds as you can put it, how would you like to comment on that?
One of the great lessons of economics is that meaning well is not sufficient for doing good. You have to actually understand a few things about how the world actually works. And if you don't take seriously the idea that people respond to incentives, that people act, that transaction costs matter, and that trade creates wealth, then you're engaged in what Sheldon Richman referred to as the intellectual equivalent of drunk driving.
That's beautiful. So I want to thank you, Dr. Art Carden and Mr. Aaron Brown, for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, very greatly appreciated. So we'll have you back again, and we'll be able to talk about these a little bit more the next time, I'm sure. This is Michael McKay and Radio Free Market. Please visit us on the web at radiofreemarket.com, where you can download this and all of our shows for free. And until next week, folks, wherever you are, please stand up for freedom. Thank you for listening.